From the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later tonight, bestselling author Neil Donald Walsh joins us. Conversations with God fame with his latest work, The Essential Path. We had our luncheon tonight with Sarah Hanna. Tom will tell you about that later on in the program. Love meeting our Coast to Coast listeners up front and personal. Here's what's happening. The U.S. Central Bank has rejected a call from a former Federal Reserve policymaker to counter President Donald Trump's trade agenda by refusing to play along and denying the president the interest rate cuts that he has demanded. Earlier on Tuesday, in an opinion piece for Bloomberg News, the former New York Fed President William Dudley called for the central bank to say it will not bail out the administration for its bad choices on trade policy. Remember that brutal sell-off last year when stocks suffered their worst December since the Great Depression? Something worse than that could happen in days, according to an analyst. Strategist Bassani Takata turned heads earlier this month with his bold call for a Lehman-style plunge. He's sticking with his prediction as market sentiment shows no signs of improving, leading him to believe that a monster sell-off could arrive this week. Now, there are reports that some CEOs of major companies are selling their stock. Let's check in with online columnist.com's Dr. John Curtis. Well, John, we're starting to hear this from a lot of people. What do you think?
Well, I think when the drumbeat, you know, gets louder and louder, I think it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. So, you know, the line between panic and rationality on Wall Street is a very thin line indeed. I would say this with respect to CEOs selling their shares. It happens all the time, and especially happens, George, when stocks are in a frothy kind of oversold capacity like they are right now. Now, remember, we're only about 1,000 points off from record highs on Wall Street. That's both in the, you know, the S&P, the NASDAQ, and the Dow. So I think the, you know, the predictions of doom and gloom here are a little bit exaggerated when you stop to think that all Trump would have to do right now is make a quick and, you know, fast a trade deal with China. And I think it would turn this entire market around very quickly. So when you talk about plunging interest rates right now, and we look at the 10-year right now, drop to, I mean, really unprecedented lows over the last 20 years, I think what we're looking at right now is a cycle in which the market is oversold, and we are in the summer, the end of the summer. So, you know, the week of, you know, prior to the, you know, the Labor Day holiday is not a good time for stocks historically. People unload, you know, their positions and then wait, you know, after the holiday in order to take positions again. So I don't really think we'll really know whether this market is the short sellers are dominating the market and this market is going down much further. And that would be maybe a correction in the name of like 10, 15, even as much as 20%. We're not going to know that until after the Labor Day holiday. If Trump makes some kind of an announcement before or around Labor Day that, you know, he's already started it today, stating that China and the U.S. are back at the table again, I think this thing could be turned around on a dime, and we could see a lot of people coming back into the market. So I would be very hesitant for people out there watching all the selling going on, especially with corporate CEOs who have a right because their compensation packages are largely stock options.
Sure.
They mature, and what are they supposed to do? Are they supposed to sell them at a new low? Or are they supposed to sell them when it's pretty frothy? Actually, if these people really had all that much insight, as a lot of people are giving them credit for, and I don't think they have any insight, really, any more than you or I do, I think they would have sold them probably about a week or two ago, you know, and not, you know, begin to unload this week. So I think those trends are simply cyclical trends of CEOs unloading stock when they can, and I think that we need to wait, not panic, and wait until after the Labor Day holiday to see where this is going.
That's Dr. John Curtis, onlinecolumnist.com. Here's a good reason to turn that frown upside down. Optimistic people live as much as 15% longer than pessimists, according to a new study spanning thousands of people in 3 decades. So don't worry, be happy. As we reported yesterday, and of course what's beginning to happen is Silicon Valley is building a Chinese-style social credit system, they say. Now what China's doing is they're restricting travel and all kinds of benefits to people who have low social credit scores. Interesting. Let's check in with our expert on the internet, Lauren Weinstein. Can it happen here? Lauren, they say it is.
Well, it can happen, but it's going to be very different. Now, of course, in China, this is all totally controlled by the government.
Right.
This is top-down. The people have no control at all. It's not a democracy, so it's a very different environment. Now, over here, the government is actually already using social media for a type of score. We're not talking Silicon Valley now. We're talking the government. They've started using social media for immigration decisions, and there have already been some kind of bizarre cases. Just in the news today, there was a case of a student who was supposed to start at Harvard next week, and he has, at least for now, been blocked from entering the country due to social media posts made by some of the people in his friends list.
Some of the people
on his friends list or followers, and that's kind of scary because many people follow or friend people that have very different views than their own.
Sure.
And guilt by association, we can't control what other people's posts are. So that's a pretty scary kind of road to be going down. Now, in terms of high tech, we certainly have companies that are trying to exert some control over the people who use their systems. And we have cases where there have been some pretty bad users, basically. So if you have someone who abuses Uber, for example, when they're taking rides, or Lyft, or who does creepy things with Airbnb, it's understandable that the companies would want to
blacklist these people.
They're not going to want to let those people use their platforms anymore. If this gets out of control, if such decisions are made in an unfair kind of manner without proper recourse and proper review, then you can have a problem. But really, from our own standpoint right now, it's not the social media credit side of this that's really controlling our lives, at least for now. It's the financial side, because when you think about it, this is kind of similar to what happens right now with credit agencies and our credit scores. All that information that's collected about us, it's not, at least right now, tied in usually with social media, but just about all the other aspects of our lives. Our scores control so much about how we live, what we can buy, what we can do. Very, very lightly regulated industries. So if we're looking for what the future might be like in terms of social media scores, I think it's wise to look at the kinds of problems we've had in the financial side, the kinds of scores we have on the financial side, and be thinking, well, what's going to happen when that's brought over to social media, or even when they're combined together?
Gosh, it's just changing so fast. Lauren, thank you so much. In the news at coasttocoastam.com, a mutant pig has been born with the face of an elephant. No mouth has been discovered after being born in a rubbish heap. A bizarre footage shows the strange-looking creature barely moving in the northern Argentine province of Salta. It appears to have an elephant-like trunk, big flappy ears, synonymous with the largest land mammals on the planet. Truly bizarre. Up next, Mark Shaw, one of our favorite guests, joins us. Denial of justice, Dorothy Kilgallen, abuse of power, and the most compelling JFK assassination investigation in history. And, of course, you know he wrote the book, The Reporter Who Knew Too Much, about Dorothy Kilgallen as well. She was the former What's My Line television star from years ago and the media icon. And Mark is next with us on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. Mark Shaw back with us, former criminal defense attorney, legal analyst for CNN, ESPN, the USA Today. Mark is an investigative reporter, author of many books, including a couple I just mentioned. We'll talk about them again. He's a member of the American Society of Journalists and Authors, has written for USA Today, Huffington Post, and the Aspen Daily News as well. And he's got some new information about the Dorothy Kilgallen case. Mark, welcome back. Always good to have
you. Thank you. It's a privilege to be on your show again, George. Thanks.
For people who don't know who Dorothy Kilgallen was, let's go back a few years and talk about her. She was a great television star on What's My Line. She was a reporter, a syndicated columnist in the gossip column. Frank Sinatra couldn't stand her. But tell us a little bit more about her.
Well, she's amazing. And how many people I've heard from around the world who've gotten to know Dorothy now. She kind of disappeared from view for about 50 years. But, you know, she was a college dropout who rose to fame. She had a column you talked about, syndicated to 200 newspapers across the country. She had a radio show she co-hosted every day, listened to by about a million people. She covered the important trials of that time in the 50s and 60s, Dr. Sam Shepard, which became the fugitive movie, Lindbergh baby kidnapping case. The New York Post called her the most powerful female voice in America, and it's amazing how many people have said we wish we had a reporter like Dorothy today, because she would be the role model for the kind of reporter we want, the ones that have integrity, the ones that go out, like you, George, that go out and find the facts and then, you know, go ahead and expose those instead of some sensational headline and then push some facts to that. So Dorothy's to be admired, and unfortunately, as you know, she covered the JFK assassination. That was her most famous case, and that's what led to her death in 1965.
They found her dead in her room and claimed that she may have had an overdose, alcohol, and you never thought that was the right story.
Well, you know, I was thinking the other day, you know, I've looked at this for about 10 years now, research on Dorothy and the JFK assassination, and I've tried to kind of at times do what Dorothy would do, investigate it like Dorothy would investigate it. And I think if she had, we can just say quickly that she was the most credible reporter to cover the JFK assassination, and we'll get into that in a minute because it's important. I found some new facts for you. But she was at the Ruby trial. She interviewed Jack Ruby, and she was writing a book for Random House. And then as it got to November of 1965, she was going to expose what she had found, all of her evidence, in a book for Random House. And unfortunately then on November 8th, she was found in a bedroom she didn't sleep in, a bed she didn't sleep in, wearing her makeup, eyelashes, and a false hairpiece, and they quickly concluded that Dorothy had died of an overdose of barbiturates. Well, as you know, George, through the autopsy inspection of it and everything, I've proven that there was a homicide. There's no question about it. There was a staged death scene, no investigation of any kind. Nobody stood up for Dorothy and said, hey, you know, she doesn't have a drug problem, she's not an alcoholic or anything. It's sad. But she disappeared, as I say, until I learned about her in about 2007, I believe, when I was working on another book. And then I took off, and I've been fighting to get her the justice she deserves ever since.
I remember Bennett Cerf, of course, who was also on What's My Line, was the founder of Random House.
Yeah,
and they were close.
He was the one that hired her to write the book. And on the last night of her life, she showed him part of the manuscript that she had finished and wanted to complete for publication by that publishing house.
Well, there's no doubt Dorothy Kilgallen was stepping on toes as she was doing her investigations. There were a lot of people in the Kennedy case, which we'll get into, that she was investigating, and I think she was really close, don't you?
Well, that's why we went ahead and published the second book, Denial of Justice. It's for people that read the first book and those that didn't. But I was able to come up with new evidence. I found the butler's daughter, Dorothy's butler's daughter in New York City, who was able to give me, she lived in the townhouse with Dorothy and was able to give me insights into Dorothy's life and times, the lavish parties, all of that. Also some information about FBI agents being in the townhouse the morning that Dorothy died. We found some connections between the Marilyn Monroe death and Dorothy's death, their obsession, both of them, along with JFK, about the about UFOs. Dorothy never bought the fact that Marilyn committed suicide, and so that then led me to something that, George, I can't even emphasize how important this is, because I've been able to really now find out why Dorothy was in such danger as November of 65 arrived. And the first thing we have to look at, I was able to get a copy of the 2,000-page Ruby trial transcripts. A reader had picked up the reporter who knew too much. He got in touch with me and asked me if I wanted a copy. He sent them. And for anyone who wants the truth about the assassinations, you got to go there first, because that sworn testimony within, what, a few months of the JFK assassination, and what I found was just shocking. First of all, There was a testimony by a gentleman who was a salesman at the Dallas Morning News, and he's asked about whether Jack Ruby was around the morning that JFK was killed. And he said, yes, he was in our offices. He got there about 12 o'clock, and he left about 12:30. And with us, he was looking out a window, George, that faced Daley Plaza, and he was there until 12:35. And as anybody who's followed the JFK assassination knows, JFK was killed at 12:25. That means that Jack Ruby was actually watching the assassination as it took place. Therefore, he had to have known about it to begin with. There is a parking lot manager across from the Ruby Carousel Club who testifies that Ruby came over the day before he shot Oswald and was talking on the phone to someone asking about when Oswald would be transferred and saying, I will be there. There's testimony that Ruby admitted he had gotten into the Dallas Police Department basement based on making like a reporter with a pencil and notebook, and the Dallas police had helped him get in there. That's just primary source witness testimony that blows away any possibility of this Oswald alone theory, and I would really suggest people take a look at these excerpts in the book. They're on my website. You can find them on the internet. But please, take a look there. And that's why we now know Dorothy was in the front row, George, of that trial, and that's what she knew. That's what she had put in her files, and that's one of the things she was going to put in the book she was writing for Random House.
And the gentlemen clubs that Ruby apparently owned, weren't they really owned by some of those who have been named as possible suspects in the JFK murder?
I'll tell you what, you're so perceptive. I was able to find a new witness who actually had been at the Carousel Club, who had interviewed and been close friends with many of the strippers who were there, and they all talked about the fact that they were scared to death to talk about Ruby shooting Oswald afterwards, because all of those gentlemen's clubs were managed and controlled by the mafia. So you're right on point with that. So I just hope people will stop and think about that kind of thing. The second thing that we found was, why was Dorothy in such danger, of course, but also she believed that somebody was leaking her evidence that she had compiled to what she called the wrong people, and that's what she had told her hairdressers and everyone. Well, the only person who was close to Kilgallen when she died was this journalist named Ron Pataki. And he was 22 years older than Kilgallen. She had kind of had a romance with him, but she was sharing her JFK assassination information with him, and she suspected him of leaking it. Well, it wasn't too long ago when a witness, a primary source, got in touch with me, a man in Las Vegas, who told me that he had heard about Pataki at the time and said, you know, he was in trouble. He got in trouble himself and with the wrong people, using that term again. And there were people in the underworld and rogue agents, government agents, who got him out of trouble, and then they squeezed him to make him leak Kilgallen's information, what she was writing and what she was going to put in her book for Random House. And when Pataki told them that she had connected Carlos Marcello, Ruby Oswald, and the CIA being involved in JFK's death, in his words, George, what he said, Dorothy Kilgallen was dead.
Wow.
It's, again, a primary witness who talks about exactly what the danger was for Dorothy as November of 1965 approached. She had all that information from the Ruby trial transcripts. She had whatever Ruby had told her, and now her information had been leaked to the wrong people, and those people could not let her write that book.
Is Pataki alive or is he dead?
He's 84 years old and he's alive in Columbus, Ohio. And if you want to get into that right now, you know that just recently I've taken a very extreme action, one that
sure
I did
have.
Not want to take.
You want his DNA?
Yes. I have filed a petition in Westchester County, New York, the Supreme Court there. Dorothy Kilgallen is buried very close to Westchester, asking that the court permit the exhuming of Dorothy Kilgallen's body for DNA testing that it be compared with that of Ron Pataki. Ron Pataki has said to two relatives, in fact, I have to thank you again, George. One of your listeners, Ken Edwards, called me after I was on the air and told me that Pataki had admitted to two relatives that he was the last person to see Kilgallen alive.
Hold on, Mark. We're going to take a break. We'll come back and pick it up right there. We'll take calls with you next hour. Mark Shaw with us. Latest book that came out in November of 2018, Denial of Justice. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, Mark Shaw with us. We'll take calls with Mark next hour. Mark, I noticed that Ron Pataki is on Facebook. You should be friends with him.
Well, he's a shifty character, I'll tell you that. I should go back just a second and tell you, you know, the paranormal aspect of this is certainly there. Dorothy, since I first learned about her, has guided me along. She's led me to evidence. She's done all kinds of things. And in fact, when I was thinking about what to do to break through this log jam that I've got with not getting her the justice she needs, I kind of came up with a DNA idea. Let's go back just a second, because you know that I did get the New York District Attorney's Office to look into Dorothy's death. They
Yep.
promised a thorough investigation and then didn't investigate hardly any of the witnesses, including Ron Pataki. I then tried to get the U.S. Attorney in New York to review the case and got nowhere. So finally, I was frustrated by all this, and I started to think about what would Dorothy do to try to see if we can't seal this whole evidence package against Pataki. He not only swore that he was the last person to see her alive, you remember he wrote some poems that have evidence in there about how she was killed, how she was poisoned with barbiturates, only the killer could know. There's all this evidence against him, and so finally, I decided to go ahead and file this action. It's a dual action to ask the Supreme Court in Westchester County, New York, to exhume Dorothy's body for DNA purposes and also order Pataki to give a DNA sample. Now, people might be thinking, wait a minute, she died way back in 1965. Can there be DNA still on her remains? And I went for the expert that anybody would go to who wanted to get the best, and that's Dr. Cyril Weck.
He is the best, and he also looked at the Kennedy assassination.
There you go. And I talked to Dr. Weck, and he gave me some ideas. He said, you know, it depends on how she was embalmed. It depends on how they got her ready for the funeral. And then I presented to him some confusion about the facts at that time, and he assured me that there is the great possibility that DNA could still be on her body. We know it could still be on Ron Pataki's, but he said to me, you know, something that really made me feel great. He said, Mark, if you can get the authority to have her body exhumed, I will supervise the retrieving of the DNA and comparing it with Ron Pataki's. And so that meant a lot to me, because he is so credible. And I think he's the right person to be able to do this if I can get permission.
He is the best, to be sure. He wrote a book with a friend of mine, Charles Bosworth Jr., about the JonBenet Ramsey case.
Oh, I didn't know that.
He's one of the best.
Yeah.
He truly
so
is.
So we'll see what happens. I filed the petition. I've served all of the parties, including the DA and the U.S. Attorney, Kilgallen's grown children, who I don't know whether they will approve of what I'm doing or not. Pataki also was served last week with the papers, and so now it'll be up to a judge to decide whether this extreme action, and I would never have taken this action, George, if the DA and the U.S. attorney back there had done their jobs,
right,
because
right.
There's this overwhelming evidence against Pataki, and what bothers me and hopefully will bother the court is that if we don't do something here to put him in that room with Dorothy Kilgallen when she was died, he's going to get away with murder, because there's little doubt that he was involved one way or another, and we now know that he leaked that information to the wrong people, and that's what caused her death. So I'm hopeful. I think before I got on, you said that optimists live longer. Well, I'm a true optimist here, because I think the odds of getting this done are probably against me, but I got to give it a try.
Has Pataki ever picked up the phone and said, Mark, lay off me, stop this?
I actually interviewed him twice. I've been straight with him. I've sent him both books. I interviewed him twice. And it's interesting because I would compile all of these things that were inconsistent. He said he was in Columbus, Ohio when Dorothy died. Then we found out that he admitted that he may have been in New York. And there's a lot of inconsistencies there through primary sources. But at one point, George, I said, you know, Ron, let's level with each other. you know and I know that you were involved with Dorothy's death one way or another. Come on, tell me, I want to know what happened back there. If you weren't involved, fine, but tell me what happened. And as I told the investigator for the New York District Attorney's Office, I said there was a pregnant pause, and I thought he was going to admit his complicity in Dorothy's death. He didn't, and unfortunately, that investigator with the DA was not allowed to investigate Pataki at all, and so we never got to that point. I'm hoping what he will do is that he will get a lawyer. And he'll go to that lawyer, and the lawyer will say, look, Ron, let's level. Were you involved in this some way? If you were, let's work this out, because otherwise you're going to end up in a courtroom in Westchester County, New York, and you're going to be asked all about this. Well, if you had something to do with it, let's go to a DA and admit that and see if we can't get the truth told about what happened to Kilgallen. That's what I'm hoping.
Now, there's no question, too, though. People knew Carlos Marcello and Santo Traficante, names that were implicated in the Kennedy assassination.
Yeah, what you need to do, and again, I go back to Dorothy as my inspiration, and I said that in the petition. You have to look at the detective's best friends, motive, means, opportunity, and benefit from the crime. And you know, George, as well as I do, that the 1960 election, Joe Kennedy knew they were going to lose unless they won West Virginia and Illinois.
That's
so
right.
He made a deal with the devil that if the mobsters, Giancana, Marcello, all of them, would help him win those states, they would leave them alone when they got in the White House. Well, they helped. And then what did Joe do? He double-crossed those people. He appointed Bobby Kennedy attorney general. I have a witness who was right there when that happened. And Joe and Bobby became attorney general, and what's the first thing he did?
He went after the mob.
Guys.
Yep.
Marcello especially, and you can't mess around with them.
He had Marcello picked up and dumped in South America, didn't he, in some forest?
Jungles down there, and then prosecuted him for racketeering and all of that. Well, Marcello's not a dumb person. His back was against the wall. If you kill Bobby Kennedy, who he hated, then John Kennedy will come after you with everything the government has. But if you kill John Kennedy, then Bobby Kennedy will be powerless. And that's exactly what happened. And that's exactly what Dorothy Kilgallen, she was a smart woman. You know, she many times they said she was better in the courtroom than the lawyers were. And she figured that all out. And unfortunately, that's what cost her life.
I'm wondering if Jimmy Hoffa had anything to do with that. Because, you know, as you know, he hated Bobby Kennedy. He hated the Kennedys.
Yeah. Yeah.
They were going after him as well. And he knew these other people.
Well, he did. And yet, as you know, George, I'm very careful. I don't speculate in my books.
No, you don't.
You're sources. I could never put that together. Did he know about it? Did he know about the assassination of JFK? I can't imagine that he didn't.
He was happy about it.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, nobody hated Bobby Kennedy more than he did. That there's that great story, I think, about him being in the offices of Bobby in New York, telling him to lay off, and Bobby said, hell with you, and he actually tried to strangle him before they took his hands off of Bobby's neck. So nobody hated more the Kennedys, and Bobby especially, than Hoffa, but I've never been able to connect him to the actual machinations of JFK's death.
That's an amazing story indeed. Now back to Dorothy and her situation. If she died from being murdered, explain how you think it would have happened in that room.
Well, I'm going to say, and I haven't been able to put all this together, but I'm working on it. I think Marilyn Monroe, the way she died, may have been a dress rehearsal for how Dorothy died. There are similarities there, as you know. Both found in bedrooms, both a barbiturate overdose, all of that.
Yep.
What I believe happened is that Pataki finally... they told him, look, we own you now. We own you, and we need to be able to get rid of Kilgallen before she writes this book. So you help us set her up. I think he met her the night before at the Regency Hotel, a few blocks from where she lived. We can pretty well place him there. I think he she had some drinks there. He could have put barbiturates in her drink there. Otherwise, he would have taken her home. He probably was joined by a couple guys. That were these agents who were going to help him do what he needed
right.
to do.
Right, I was going to say he could have opened the door for them.
Exactly, and that's they could have then, put that poison in her drink there at the townhouse. Then basically what they did is they looked around, I believe, for that manuscript that she had for her JFK file that had everything in it. Both have never been found. And one way or another, they took those, because we then know from the butler's daughter, which is a piece of the equation here, that FBI agents or agents, you know, trying to act as FBI agents were in the townhouse the morning Dorothy died, and they were confiscating her files and her documents and taking them into the street. So all of that kind of fits together now, and I feel much better about the fact that I can pretty well dictate what happened from the time she was at the Ruby trial all the way up until she died that night, that tragic death that took her away from us.
Where was her husband, Richard Colmar, during this situation?
Well, that's a sad situation in many ways. Richard was a successful Broadway producer when she met him. He fell on hard times. He had some failures there with a couple restaurants, and he became an alcoholic. They became estranged. Dorothy, in the book, I use, you know, in my both books, it's warts and all. Dorothy ran around. She, you know, she had a relationship with Johnny Ray, who was the singer, Little White Cloud That Cried.
Mm-hmm.
She then had the relationship with Pataki. And there, you know, both books are set up as true crime murder mysteries. I mean, you mentioned Frank Sinatra. He could have knocked her off. He hated her so much for what she'd said about him. Richard is a suspect. There are others as well, including J. Edgar Hoover, who she believed had covered up the JFK assassination, all of those. But, you know, there was one thing that was interesting that you would find at the funeral, actually. Dorothy's mother pointed at Richard and said, "You killed my daughter, and I will prove it."
Oh, geez.
That was that accusation was never followed up. I don't believe that he had the guts to have done it, but he very well could have, because he knew. She told everyone she was scared. If the wrong people know about, knew what I know about the JFK assassination, it cost me my life. She bought a gun, and she changed her will. And Richard may have felt like that, you know, it was time for her to die before that will was changed. But I've never been able to really put together how he would have actually committed the murder.
Jack Ruby told Kilgallen something before he died.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think he told her?
Well, it's interesting. If you go to the DorothyKilgallenStory.org, you're going to see all of these videotaped interviews. And the most shocking one is with Joe Tannehill, who is Melvin Belli's co-counsel representing Ruby.
Mm-hmm.
And he details how it happened, that Dorothy said that she had a message from Ruby's friend, a opera singer in San Francisco. And that was relayed to Ruby, and that she wanted to talk to him, and finally that was agreed. You can see in denial of justice exactly where they sat in the courtroom, right behind the railing. They talked twice. I believe that she, we don't have an account of that, because her file was missing. But where did she go right after Ruby talked to her? She didn't go to, she didn't stay in Dallas to look at LBJ as being involved in JFK's death. She didn't go to Washington, D.C. She didn't go anywhere else. She went to New Orleans. So I think Ruby admitted to her that, yes, he knew Oswald, and there's all kinds of evidence about that, and that Marcella was the one that masterminded the JFK assassination. And he tried to tell all of that to the Warren Commission, but they wouldn't listen to him, and they didn't even subpoena Dorothy to come before the Warren Commission. In fact, there's an interesting a letter that I found. Again, I think Dorothy kind of led me to this. It's a letter from J. Edgar Hoover to the Warren Commission counsel, and they are upset because Dorothy had printed the Ruby testimony before the Warren Commission before it was supposed to be released. So they sent these two agents over to her home. And I have this visualization of these two bulky agents and little Dorothy sitting there, and they're interrogating her. And they come back to Hoover, and in that letter it says that Dorothy told, they ask about her source, and that's where her famous quote is, "I would rather die than give you my sources." So, you know, there's that connection where Hoover was very, very upset with what Kilgallen had done, and obviously he could have been involved in her death. But I have a feeling that he stayed away from that, that it was more or less the Marcello people along with these rogue agents who actually committed the murder.
So Sarah Wecht is about 88 years old now, isn't he?
Oh, he's smarter than either one of us, George. I'll tell you that at that age. He's just
still sharp, huh?
Sharp as can be. And, You know, what I'm interested in with him is, again, he's a man with integrity. You know, he hasn't assured me that we're going to find anything there. But he said to me, you know, I believe there's DNA available. And I used that in my petition in the very first paragraph because I hope it gives legitimacy to what is going to happen. George, I'm going to be castigated for what I'm doing. It's an extreme thing to do to bother Dorothy's remains. The family may be upset. Others have. I've already received some emails about how could you do this. Mm-hmm. I'm still interested in justice.
Well, then you still don't know if you're going to be able to exhume the body.
No, I don't. But even my doing it has made me quite unpopular with some people. And I believe that hopefully having Dr. Weck involved gives it legitimacy, that I'm after justice for Dorothy, and that we're hoping that this guy, Pataki, is not going to get away with murder. Now, you know, the other thing I can hope is that the DA finally comes around and says, hey, we will do a thorough investigation, or the U.S. attorney does that. I want a grand jury investigation. And I think you want to talk a little bit about the Epstein case, because there is some similarity mm-hmm. to Dorothy's situation in 1965 when she died.
Yeah, we'll talk about that at the top of the hour
sure.
with phone
so,
calls.
Dr. Weck, bless him. You know, hopefully the court will be impressed that somebody with the integrity and credentials he has, if he's involved with a guy like me, you know, out there trying to do what I can, that this is a legitimate request, and hopefully they'll look at it seriously.
What would Pataki do if he went to law enforcement and said, look, I know who did this. Mm-hmm. I didn't have anything to do with it other than I knew these people.
Yeah, I don't think he may not have known, you see, what he told the wrong people was going to result in Dorothy's death. He may have thought they would scare her, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
If I was his lawyer, I'd walk him into a DA's office. He's 84 years old.
Cut a deal.
And I would say, let's work this out some way or another, you know, and you probably could, whether they would have him plead to a misdemeanor or something else like that, or a felony or whatever, there'd be no jail time. And I've said to him in person, and I've said to him in a letter that I wrote to him when he was served with a petition, Ron, you know, why don't you get this off of your chest? I know you have some guilt over this. We both do. Why don't you do the right thing here and let us know what happened to Dorothy Kilgallen, because you're the one that can
do
it.
Did he ever respond to you?
No.
What a story.
No, not yet. But I'm that optimist.
You are. And you don't let go. Mark, we'll talk about the Epstein case, which is just as bizarre, and then we'll take calls next on Coast to Coast AM.